Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, this is the release date of George W. Bush's memoir and the attending media circus. The former president is doing Matt Lauer, Oprah, Good Morning America, and I'm losing track of what else already. The book is called Decision Points, but what can a nation that lived through 8 years of President Bush's decisions, love him or hate him, have left to learn from a president whose term ended so recently? Well, we can learn that the worst moment of his presidency, for him at least, was when Kanye West dissed him. Here's NBC's Matt Lauer asking about that post-Katrina telethon where Lauer brought Kanye West on stage.
I introduced Kanye West. Were you watching?
No.
You remember what he said?
Yes, I do.
George Bush doesn't care about black people.
Call me racist.
Well, what he said was, George Bush doesn't care about black people.
That says he's a racist. And I didn't appreciate it then, and I don't appreciate it now. It's one thing to say, you know, I don't appreciate the way he's handled his business. It's another thing to say this man's a racist. I resent it. It's not true. And it was one of the most disgusting moments of my presidency.
This is from the book. I faced a lot of criticism as president. I didn't like hearing people claim that I lied about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction or cut taxes to benefit the rich. But the suggestion that I was racist because of the response to Katrina represented an all-time low.
Yeah, still feel that way as you read those words. Felt them when I heard them, felt them when I wrote them, and I felt them when I'm listening to them.
You say you told Laura at the time it was the worst moment of your presence.
Yes.
I wonder if some people are going to read that and they might give you some heat for that. And the reason is this.
I don't care.
Well, here's the reason. You're not saying that the worst moment in your presidency was watching the misery in Louisiana. You're saying it was when someone insulted you because
now,
of it.
I also make it clear that the misery in Louisiana affected me deeply as well. There's a lot of tough moments in the book. And this is a disgusting moment, pure and simple.
President Bush, still very bothered. And with that, let's talk about what's new in the Bush memoir and about the media circus now underway. With me, James Gordon Meek, Daily News Washington correspondent, and Ann Kornblut, national politics reporter for The Washington Post. We'll also hear several more clips of the president on NBC. And James and Ann, welcome back to WNYC. Thanks for coming on for this.
Thanks for having us.
And as far as you know, had Bush said that before about the worst moment of his presidency? That's how he put it in the book.
No, and in fact, there's a lot of things in this book that he hadn't said before, especially things assessing his presidency, because he really went underground for the first 2 years, I mean, since he left office until now with the book rollout, a very strategic rollout of this book and a very strategic silence on his part. He did get pressed, as you played, by Lauer about whether that should really be considered the worst moment of his presidency, the fact that he was called something as opposed to the hurricane itself. But it was clear from watching the interview, for everyone who saw it, that he was really bothered by it, more bothered by that than the questions about the Iraq war or 9/11, in fact.
And that's already causing some reaction in the hip-hop world. Here's how one editor of a hip-hop site is responding, as quoted on Salon. Kanye West is in the news again, asked Andreas Hale, editor-in-chief of TheWellVerse.com. In all seriousness, Bush mentioning Kanye today does nothing but help him promote My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy and make Bush look like a crybaby. Kanye is now 2 for 2 when it comes to presidents speaking his name. The other one was Clinton. Not too bad in my book. As for Bush being disgusted with Kanye calling him a racist, I think GW is hard of hearing. Kanye said he doesn't care about black people, but if the shoe fits. And James, that's an interesting distinction that editor is making, not caring about black people and being racist as two different things. I guess people will judge if they think they're the same or not.
Well, I guess if you're the guy who's told on national television that you don't care about black people, I think you're probably going to take that as a pretty clear shot at you being a racist. So, you know, and that's a personal attack rather than a policy attack. And so the president, writing a very personal memoir, is clearly making the case that, hey, I'm a human being too, and I'm not a racist, and I don't hate black people. I mean, this is a guy who had in his cabinet, he had the first black national security advisor, the first black secretary, two black secretaries of state. you know, I think he makes a pretty good argument that he's not a racist, and he's put his money where his mouth is. So I think, you know, that's kind of interesting. It is interesting that he didn't seem to speak about the Iraq War in quite the same emotional terms, but I know from my own reporting that he is very emotional about the Iraq War. He has spent a lot of a tremendous amount of private time with families of the fallen, and that those are not easy meetings for a lot of people who feel that, in many cases, that their loved ones should not have died.
One thing I noticed, Bush uses the word blindsided on at least two occasions in the book to refer to very big things, to talk about how he was only informed about the Abu Ghraib incidents on the day that the photos hit 60 Minutes, and blindsided by the collapse of the banking system. And let's play a clip relevant to that. To Matt Lauer on NBC, he said TARP was a tough call against his free market philosophy, but what his top aide said he had to do.
I'm paraphrasing at this point. You better do something big, because if we don't, you're liable to oversee a depression. So the decision point here is, do you adhere to your philosophy and say, let them all fail?
Free market.
Yeah, free market. Or do you take taxpayers' money and inject it into the system in hopes that you prevent a depression? And I chose the latter.
Yeah, you're right that, you know, I abandoned the free market to save the free market system.
I did. And I also put in there my friends in Midland are going to say, what happened to Bush?
Yeah, where was that conservative?
Yeah, what happened? But when you're the president and somebody says, hey, if you don't do something strong, there may be a depression, it gets your attention. At least it got mine.
So Ann Kornbluth from The Washington Post, that was quite an exchange for me. I wonder what you took from it. For one thing, there's no indication that as split as the country is on TARP to this day, as split as certainly Republicans have been on TARP, that there was no dissent within his economics team, no serious debate as to whether that was the right thing to do. Just, hey, people told me, got to do this to avoid a depression, and that gets your attention. Did you get that same impression?
Well, sure. I'll say two things about that. You got that impression not only from him and from his recounting of it, but from politicians actually on both sides of the aisle who were living through those moments. And that's one reason it became such a flashpoint in the campaign, but it's also a reason you saw Democrats and Republicans uniting the way they did. And Bush gets into it. It's one of the more riveting scenes in the book, I have to say, where he describes not only that, but also having both McCain and Obama and Pelosi into the White House to discuss what they were going to do next. But I will say that, like other moments in the book, the fact that there wasn't a whole lot of dissent is a theme. And we heard it from him last night, where he said that he didn't have, when he was talking about going into the Iraq War, that he didn't have any doubts about there being weapons of mass destruction. And when he was pressed on it, and Matt Lauer said, well, there were dissenting voices, he said, well, yes, and I consider myself one of the dissenting voices because I didn't want to go to war. But obviously they did. And then he talked about being sickened when there was no discovery of the weapons of mass destruction. But there are a couple of moments where the lack of dissent is pretty striking.
Well, who's making the decisions, James, or who made the decisions, since this book is called Decision Points, in this administration? He seems to say that, well, my advisors told me that I should do this with TARP, so I guess I had to do it. Or he was a dissenter. That's an amazing word for a president to use in his memoir with respect to the war that he decided to start. I was a dissenter. I didn't want to go to war. Well, who was making those decisions?
Well, George W. Bush called himself the decider, famously, and he was. And I think when you hear him speak to Lauer, you know, sometimes Bush is, and often by his own admission, his own worst enemy in the way that the posture that he takes. For example, when he said, you know, he was asked about getting Osama bin Laden after 9/11, he said, dead or alive, and he now regrets that. He's expressed a lot of regrets about statements such as that, or bring it on, when he told the Iraqi, al-Qaeda in Iraq, bring it on, and they did. But if you kind of, there's an interesting... So on the surface, you have this guy who's very confident, and he's giving these interviews, and he's unapologetic, Brian. He's not He's not saying, I'm sorry that there weren't weapons of mass destruction. He's saying the war wasn't a mistake. He said, I'm glad that Saddam Hussein is gone and dead. He has consistently been a guy who makes a decision, and whether it turns out to be a bad decision point, to use his term, he sticks with it. And a lot of people, even his political enemies or people who were opponents of Bush, admired the fact that the guy wasn't squishy. He would make a decision, and he would stick with it. And if it didn't work out right, he would try to find a way out of it, but he wouldn't back off from the wisdom of his original decision, whether right or wrong. And he came off in that way as a very strong leader, particularly as he became more seasoned as a president. And I think that certainly was very clear in these interviews.
We're talking about President Bush's new memoir, Decision Points, and some of the media circus around it today with James Gordon Meek from the Daily News and Ann Kornblut from the Washington Post. And by the way, we have a way that you can participate in this today on our politics website. It's a free country. org. He was the first internet era president, really, and as such, most of his presidency was captured on video and has found its way to YouTube. So our politics website is gathering your video decision points, the defining YouTube clips of the Bush presidency, according to you. People have started to put some up there already, and you can add to the collection. You can see the pics that are there from Bush's final press conference, for example, and submit your own video. Take it from YouTube, post it to itsafreecountry.org. President Bush's greatest YouTube decision points, according to you, we'll collect them, and you can see them on the site as they come in. I want to continue on this idea, though, that other people seem to make up his mind for him in many a cases. In many a case. We've been through what we were just discussing, and another clip from his conversation with Matt Lauer is about waterboarding, which, as we will hear, he brought up. He obviously wrote about it. He obviously wanted to talk about it. But again, let's listen to how he attributes the decision that this was a legal tactic.
Let's talk about waterboarding.
Okay.
We believe America is going to be attacked again. There's all kinds of intelligence coming in. And one of the high-valued Al-Qaeda operatives was Khalik Sheikh Mohammed, chief operating officer of Al-Qaeda, ordered the attack on 9/11. And they say, he's got information. I said, find out what he knows. And so I said to our team, are the techniques legal? And a legal team says, yes, they are. And I said, use them.
Why is waterboarding legal, in your opinion?
Because the lawyer said it was legal. He said it did not fall within the Anti-Torture Act. I'm not a lawyer. But you got to trust the judgment of people around you, and I do.
You say it's legal, and the lawyers told me.
Yeah.
Critics say that you got the Justice Department to give you the legal guidance and the legal memos that you wanted. Tom Kaine, who was the former Republican co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, said they got legal opinions they wanted from their own people.
He obviously doesn't know. I hope Mr. Kaine reads the book. That's why I've written the book. He can draw whatever conclusion they want, but... I will tell you this, using those techniques saved lives. My job was to protect America, and I did.
President Bush with Matt Lauer on NBC. Ann Kornblut, again, I mean, people will debate the rightness or wrongness of waterboarding, obviously. Lauer pressed him on what Tom Kaine said about skewing the legal opinions or hand-picked legal opinions. But as with the TARP, it almost sounded like, well, you know, the economics experts told me, or the legal advisors told me, so must have been true.
Like, yes,
not a lot of independent thinking there.
Yes, although in the case of TARP, he does make it clear that this is something where there was a consensus and it had to happen, and we know from independent reporting that there was, in real time, something of a consensus, at least from the so-called experts, that TARP needed to happen. Whereas when it came to waterboarding and what many would call torture, there was no such consensus. There hasn't been since, and we know that there were a few people in the administration, and particularly a few lawyers at the Justice Department and in the White House, House who drove that train. And what's interesting is to see President Bush really inserting himself into that, taking full responsibility for it. You know, he could have just as easily said, there was a big debate, we thought about it, I was really bothered by it, in the end I was persuaded by the lawyers. And instead he says what you just played, which is that he asked if it was legal, they said yes, no further questions, go for it. And that isn't something we've heard from him before, and I think we've heard certainly Vice President Cheney talk at length about the need, in his view, for waterboarding and what it yielded, particularly in the case of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. But we hadn't heard President Bush talk about it quite that way and fully take responsibility for something that not only was controversial in real time, but has since been repudiated by this administration.
James, one of the decisions that President Bush did make in opposition to Cheney was the decision to commute the sentence but not pardon Scooter Libby in the Valerie Plame affair. The quote is, the jury verdict should be respected. In one of our final meetings, I informed Dick that I would not issue a pardon. The vice president was not happy. He stared at me with an intense look. I can't believe you're going to leave a soldier on the battlefield. What's your understanding of that moment? That's an interesting characterization of Scooter Libby's role. I don't think he was in Afghanistan or Iraq, spying on Valerie, no. Or outing Valerie Plame as an agent, leave a soldier on the battlefield. But what's your understanding of why, as much as Bush, A, did listen to Cheney, B, did really believe in the rightness of all the stuff that they had to do with respect to the post 9/11 world, why did he depart on that point?
Well, as it happens, Brian, you're in luck. I covered the Libby trial for a couple months, and then my boss, Washington Bureau Chief Tom DeFrank, has done a lot of reporting about the decision, Cheney pressing Bush almost daily at the end of the administration to pardon his former chief of staff for who had been convicted of perjury in the Valerie Plame leak probe. We talked about this at the time. Bush's statement that he issued when he commuted but did not pardon Libby could not have been more clear. He had given orders to his staff to cooperate with Pat Fitzgerald and his special prosecutor probe, and Scooter Libby didn't. He lied to a grand jury and he lied to FBI agents, and that's a federal crime. And as far as Bush was concerned, whatever his service, he felt the sentence was unfair, but he felt the conviction was just. A jury of his peers had convicted him. I read that, and I realized that Bush was never going to pardon this guy. Cheney did not. Cheney did not give up hope. He was loyal to Scooter Libby, and he kept pressing him to the annoyance of Bush, as my boss, Tom DeFrank, reported around the time that Bush left office, or shortly thereafter. One thing that sealed the deal, Bush never liked pardons going back to his days as governor of Texas because he felt they were sort of inherently corrupt, that only people with the means or money could, you know, spend the money on lawyers to work their way through that process of getting a pardon. There was a Brooklyn developer who had been, I think it was from Staten Island, who had been involved in the subprime mortgage crisis, and Bush had pardoned him on Christmas Eve right before he left office. And we found in the Daily News, looking at this FEC records, that this guy's father had donated $30,000 to the GOP right before beginning a process to try to get his son a pardon. And his son was not qualified for a pardon under Justice Department rules. They went around it through the White House counsel's office, and somehow or other ended up in Bush's desk, and he signed it. Bush read about this in the Daily News, was absolutely mortified that this had happened. Of course, he insisted that he had not, you know, that this had not been a paid-for, bought pardon. But the appearance of it was so atrocious that he spent a lot of time on that in his final days in office, and he revoked the pardon of this guy, Toosey. Who he had given a pardon to. And that had never happened in the history of the Republic. No president had ever revoked his own pardon of somebody who was a convicted criminal. And that sealed Scooter Libby's fate. There was no question after the Toosey fiasco that Scooter Libby was going to get a pardon. It looked so bad.
That's a really interesting story. Let me play one more clip from Bush on NBC with Matt Lauer talking about his new memoir, Decision Points. And this is about popularity, because his opinion, the opinion polls on him were so low by the time he left office. And to me, this is very timely because we've all been talking for the last week since the election about President Obama's popularity going down. The Republicans who've been elected say he should have foregone the health care bill when he realized the American people were against it, or as the polls show, they were divided on it, but but that's the argument that when people started to turn against it, he should have said, this is what I want, but it's not the American people want what the American people want. And here's Matt Lauer asking President Bush really a related question.
When you left office, President Bush, your popularity numbers are around 30%, give or take, depending on the poll. You say it didn't bother you.
No, it didn't.
You know, I try to personalize that. I think I've been doing this job for 14 years.
Yeah.
And if after 14 years, only 30% of people who've watched this show think I did a good job,
they'll fire you.
It's going to hurt like hell.
I don't think it does. No, because I also was, as you mentioned at one time, over 90%. I didn't take it seriously then. I didn't take it seriously when I left office. Somebody walked up to me the other day and said, congratulations, your popularity is way up since you left office. And my answer was, so what? Seriously. I mean, if you chase popularity, you're chasing a moment. You're chasing a puff of air.
You're chasing a puff of air. And Ann Kornblut from The Washington Post, you know, it strikes me to tie it to the present that President Obama now, since the election, has been saying it was a failure of communication on his part with respect to health care, not a failure of policy, that the people don't understand why this is right for them. And so he doesn't care about public opinion. And he's getting roundly criticized for that. And here's President Bush saying the same thing. And maybe that's just exactly what a policymaker has to say after they make a decision that they really believe in. You know, sticking with it against public opinion is a good thing if it's you. It's a bad thing if it's the other party.
Well, they all say it to a certain extent. You know, listening to that clip, it's for any of us who covered Bush, in the campaign, as I did, going all the way back to 2000 and through his presidency. That is the Bush we all knew. He started in the 2000 campaign saying he didn't pay attention to polls, and that was only somewhat believable because they all do. But over time, you really saw that he didn't care what people thought about him. He didn't have that same kind of needy strain that other politicians do, and really worrying, staying up late, worrying about what people thought of him. And he got a lot of respect, even from the other side at times, for his defiance and his convictions. And it worked particularly well, especially after 9/11. So it's just interesting to hear him the same as he was then, but even more so. President Obama is a little bit different in that he ruminates on it aloud somewhat more. He doesn't strike quite the same tone that Bush did, but he has stood by it, and I think you may be right. That's something presidents have to do. He certainly can't go back in time. Neither of them could go back in time and reverse their less popular decisions. But for whatever reason, we tend to ask them questions about their regrets or their contrition, and that's not something that any politician with a healthy ego likes to get into, but certainly not President Bush.
Now we're over time. We have New York's newest congressman standing by, Republican Michael Grimm, who was just elected last week. But just take a half a minute and answer that same question, James, if you like, about the comparison between, you know, popularity and policy in the one administration and the other.
Well, Bush was, I mean, all presidents look at polls. You know, I just think I want to make a point, though, about this president's relationship with Dick Cheney, which was great in the first term and terrible in the second term. This president relied heavily on the advice of a lot of people in the first term, including going to war in Iraq. And he realized, and this is, again, according to the reporting of my colleague Tom DeFrank, that he had been sold a bill of goods by the neocons. And he got rid of most of them, except for Cheney. And he continued to rely on Cheney for advice, but he realized that being greeted with flowers in the streets of Baghdad was a short-lived thing, and that he had been, sold a bill of goods. I give him credit for coming to that realization and doing something about it.
Does he write that in the book explicitly?
I haven't read the book, so I don't know. I've only seen the interviews.
And I haven't
but I look
seen,
forward to reading the book.
And I haven't seen anything that direct.
No, nothing that direct. And I've read parts of it. I haven't read all of it. Not that fast a reader, but I've started, but I haven't seen anything that direct.
Well, and
the president has shaped their own history, Brian, and that's what he's doing here.
But it also, James, begs a question as to how informed about the nuances of foreign policy somebody needs to be before they become president of the United States, so they're not susceptible to being sold a bill of goods, doesn't it?
That's a great point. But now let's also see what Dick Cheney's memoir says, because I have a feeling it's going to be a bit more acerbic and a bit more poison-filled.
All right. Well, we'll have you back at that point. James Gordon Meek, Daily News Washington correspondent, and Kornblut, national politics reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we will, in just a minute, meet New York City's newest congressman, Michael Grimm. Stay with us.